Let's go to our Monday experts. And I'm honoured to have Henry Liu in the studio. He is the trans, or has been the translator for every Prime Minister in New Zealand since Sir Geoffrey Palmer. His expertise is translating and interpreting, and he's in the Wellington studio to answer your questions and a few of mine. Hi, Henry.
Kia ora, Jesse.
Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
We better do this to start with. What's the difference between translating and interpreting?
Well, as you have introduced on earlier in the program, one's using the written medium, and translation is from one written medium to another, so from one written language to another, and interpreting is from a spoken language to another, so another spoken language. So it's interesting to hear quite often in all media, but Radio New Zealand's not immune from that, to say that it's a voice of a translator. Well, translators don't normally speak. Well, not in public. So, it's quite confusing to lots of people. Plus the fact that in English you say an interpretation. Well, it sounds like it's from somebody subjectively.
Yeah. Now, how many languages are you familiar with?
That's always the question that we get asked. I suppose the standard answer will be, how much drinks have I had?
But does that improve you or make you worse?
Well, it depends. But I mean, most of us work in a small number of languages because you have to be, you know, very specific in what we work in, and also in specific areas. So even in my own language pair, for example, if you ask me to do mining in a conference in mining, I wouldn't know anything about it, even though it's first language to you and me.
Because there's so much technical language that it would be too difficult for you to keep up?
Yes, but it's also because, I mean, ultimately you want what people want from a translator and an interpreter, in either written or the oral medium, is to be authentic. Is to actually sound like what it needs to be sounding like. So whether it's in written text, if it is a legal text, you need to write like a lawyer. If it is a mining conference, you need to sound like a mining expert. So in order to do that, you can only work in quite limited areas.
Yeah. Here's a weird question, but
okay.
If you have a French person talking to an English person, English-speaking person, can you do it both ways? Can you listen to what the French person has said, translate or interpret for the English person, and then return fire, going back English to French?
That depends on the professional, and also depends on the context, I guess. I mean, what commonly we call consecutive interpreting, which means that it happens consecutively in a dialogue situation, then most interpreters do go both directions. Conference interpreters, the one that you often see in meetings with headphones and so on, up in the booth somewhere in a glass door, most of us in working in that context works in one direction. Again, it's because of the demand that needing to be both professional sounding as well as in one authentic in the languages that you can actually work in authentically.
Yeah, so. If, for example, and I know this is one you're familiar with, John Key is sitting down with the Chinese premier.
Oh, yes.
Xi Jinping, I think it is. And yes. There would always be two of you in the room, you translating for John Key, so John Key, and then interpreting, and then another interpreter working for the Chinese leader. Would that be standard?
Well, yes, ideally. I mean, that is the international practice for a number of reasons. One is actually, I mean, there was an uproar, for example, a couple of years ago when President Trump was talking to President Putin with only one interpreter. So there was the issue of both in terms of the fact that you work with the people you trust, because your interpreter is somebody that you need to trust to project both receive the messages correctly in the nuanced way that it is absolutely appropriate, and it's also delivering that in the way that you want it to be delivered. So of course, in a high-stakes situation, you'd like to have your own interpreter to project and to receive the message.
Yeah, I guess you can keep half an eye on what the other translator is or interpreter is saying too, right? To make sure that...
And you do. And you do. I mean, both working collegially, as well as if there is an issue, then we often do collaborate. There are times when we can't collaborate, but most of the time, when you're working at high levels, you sort of know each other, and that, you know, you work for your head of state or for your head of delegation. But you know, people in that circle is quite small.
Does it change your view of how language works when you become an interpreter?
I think anyone who works in languages in a very detailed way, no different to, you know, to you as in journalism and in radio, would be that you become much more careful about what you say and how you say it, because language matters, and each word that you use or each phrasing that you use, and in fact even the way you produce that, you articulate that, makes a huge difference, and that's something that, you know, technology can only approximate, and in fact sometimes, you know, causing more confusion than it's worth. But be that as it may, it is a very human thing, everyone becomes more sensitive the more you work in.
What's the hardest language to learn?
Oh, I wouldn't have a clue. I think every language, so long as it's foreign and you don't have the expertise, you don't have the environment, it's hard to learn, whether it is tonal or whether it's got, you know, 26 endings and different types of things. Everyone's different. But I always tell people when people ask me that, you know, it's, if you're motivated, there are enough native speakers in every language. Well, some are more endangered than others, but, you know, when you're born and your mother speak to you and your father speak to you and your village speak to you, it doesn't become difficult.
Someone sent me a message, and if you've got a question for Henry, our expert on translating and interpreting, you can text it through to 2101. Someone would like to know if there's a lot of difference in interpreting Cantonese and Mandarin into English. Any difference between those two languages?
I guess, well, so technically they are, one's a dialect and one's a language. Whether that's the official terms. I think, you know, if there has been quotes of saying, you know, a dialect is a language without an army. So whether one is more different than the other is a matter of debate. But I think one of the harder things to deal with, for example, is if there's a Mandarin is an official language of a nation or of a number of nations, and so there is standard versions, whereas a non-standard language or a non-official language may not have a standard, or the standard might be a bit different. So I think that could be one thing in that context. But and of course, for example, Cantonese officially, if you want to deal with it that way, cannot be written. But of course, there's plenty of media in Hong Kong that's writing in Cantonese. And earlier, there has been some discussions about how important it is to actually bring those languages or those written texts out, so that it be able to be actually seen in a wider context. Also, in that sense, machine translation or that sort of automated context, it's harder to work in a language that doesn't have an official corpus or official database, if you like. And that could also cause some different in approach.
Henry, if you and somebody else adept was doing the same job of interpreting, would you likely be interpreting everything the same way, or is there a lot of discretion or choices that you make?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. I think it's like no two journalists would actually approach the same problem, the same issue, or witness the same thing the same way. And I think it's the same thing with translators and interpreters. There is no one correct way, because it's all about perspective. And it's also about what is important, both in terms of the one who's actually producing the message, if you know the person who's going to do that or the persons doing that, or what is more important for the receiving end, for example. And I suppose the other question is, how much do we professionals actually interfere with the message, or as lawyers or politicians might think that we interfere with the message? But I think there must be a difference, because I think who interprets matters. Which is why, you know, certain, you know, well, heads of state, for example, or some certain delegations wouldn't want to work with certain, they will only work with certain people that they trust, because they want to make sure that the perspective is right. And the same thing applies. I think this is something quite interesting. So not forgetting the fact that interpreting and translation is not just in the languages that we know. So, for example, one of our official languages, New Zealand Sign Language, deaf people has to live every day with interpreters. That's the way they have to be able to communicate and connect with the world. So we have more and more now deaf professionals who are actually interacting daily with other professionals, and they would use different interpreters for different purposes, you know, whether they are public speaking, whether they are actually in internal meetings, or whether it's so different contexts, you would want different interpreters to produce your voice, because that's actually your voice.
We've got a couple of questions coming in for you, Henry.
Sure.
Someone wants to know how you deal with content that might be rude or inappropriate when you're interpreting, particularly in a diplomatic or political setting.
Well, it depends on whether the politicians or the speaker actually intends it to be rude. If it intends to be rude, then you communicate the rudeness.
You don't use your discretion as to whether to pass it on.
Well, I mean, yes, sure. But I mean, I think if it is unintentionally rude or unintentionally insensitive, then I suppose in certain contexts you want to avoid a diplomatic incident. And same thing in the commercial setting or in a day-to-day community setting. But there is some discretion. And I think, you know, coming back to that idea that just before the break and sympathy to the people in Christchurch who are in that situation. But I think it's interesting to think about that translation and interpreting is it's a very live thing. It's a very subjective thing as well. So, for example, last year there's a new version, new translation of the Odyssey by first time for a woman translator, Professor Emily Wilson. And that was an interesting discussion about the fact that, A, the translator is a woman, so the version is different and with different emphasis. And it's also a modern translation, so translation also changes over time. So I think that's something to bear in mind. That's why I think it's so important to think about who you're working with as well as just the message.
That might not seem obvious to everyone listening, that because a woman was doing the translating that it would be any different than if a man was doing it. Can you explain that to us?
Well, I think everyone is different, but in terms of how she would put particular emphasis on the interaction from a woman's perspective. So, like your earlier question, a lot of how you receive the message, because we are human, so we receive a message moderated by our experience and moderated by who we are. How the message, not only is it an objective message, but it's also how
interpreters, how do you see it growing, reducing or changing entirely given machine translations and demand for online content from other places?
Well, there is no shortage of requirement or need for translation and interpreting, because the more globalized we are, the more communication we need. Now, of course, some people would like to be more isolated and don't hear anything about the outside. That's perfectly fair, in the automatic bubble. But on the other hand, I think, you know, the hype of machine translation being able to take over or replace translators and interpreters is probably as difficult as singularity. The concept that machine would actually think and actually replace humans in all aspects, because after all, translation and interpreting is such a human experience, such about connection, such a matter about, as you say, about how to convey an ambiguity or about rudeness. Machine doesn't know what is rude. So how would you do that? So I certainly think the demand is there. The demand is ever rising. The more interaction we have, the more translation we need, the more interpreting we need, because the more demand for wanting to know about the others, wanting to know about information that we currently don't have access to. And you know, earlier your guests on television is a huge example. You know, now we've got Netflix and we have everything else. We can watch a Nordic series and with subtitles everywhere we go, and the same thing applies of having our content actually being translated, New Zealand content, to elsewhere in a very specifically New Zealand way. Those are the things that actually are much more important now. The authenticity and where it's coming from and who your audience is much more than now just broadly, this is an English translation or a Spanish translation. So absolutely, all for the encouragement of young people wanting to think about this as a career, because this is not something that is going to be replaceable.
Someone would like to know what sort of clearance you need to translate for government officials, and I guess I'd add to that what sort of ethics you have around being involved in those high-level meetings.
So all translation, it doesn't necessarily, I mean, we shouldn't think about politicians or diplomats being in a different shoes as a refugee or as somebody who, a Kiwi New Zealanders, I mean, New Zealanders who don't speak English for whatever reason, or a deaf New Zealander. So I think the key message is the fact that not everybody can translate or should translate or interpret. There are codes of ethics by all professional associations and requirements of what one can or cannot divulge or in how we should practice. So confidentiality is an absolute, whether you're a politician or a refugee, there's no, the message is equally important. And we try to be impartial unless we declare otherwise, or we are required otherwise in a pre understanding event, and of course it's accurate. Now, what is accurate? Well, that's also we've already, you know, spent about, you know, a few minutes on what actually is accuracy. Who's viewpoint is accurate. So those are the three primary construct of professional standards. But in terms of the confidentiality, I think this is much more important now. Because of the fact that some of this is mediated in technology. So if you are using, you know, every time you use Google Translate, you're actually providing information to Google. And the same thing applied. I mean, imagine if you're using platforms of interpreting in refugee context, which has happened, you know, in Europe, for example, with the Greek migrant crisis. Some of that was being mediated in technology on iPads. That means it's in the cloud. Now, some of this are very, very sensitive information. Who's actually managing that? So I think the confidentiality discussion is getting more and more permanent.
What about notes, Henry? What if you've got this big high-level meeting between, you know, the Chinese leader and the New Zealand leader, and you're kind of making notes? What do you do with those at the end of the day?
So yes, absolutely. I mean, so notes is a very much a personal thing in terms of how we write notes, and I think, you know, earlier, in the presidency of Trump, there was some, you know, discussion about subpoenaing the interpreter for what has been spoken and getting the notes. Different jurisdictions have different ways of approaching that. Most of the time, it is our responsibility to keep it confidential. And if not, and there are certain protocols in New Zealand, we destroy the notes with MFAT. So there are different ways to ensure that it doesn't go into the wrong hands.
Is there a lag, by the way, when you're interpreting for someone between what they say and you turning it into an intelligible version in a different language?
Yes. I think, you know, it's, I describe it in a slightly different way, and you're into music and so on, so it's easy to appreciate, and some of our audience would know that. It's a little bit like sight reading. And in the sense that there has to be an interpretation, there has to be a processing, cognitive processing. It's not instantaneous, even though it's called simultaneous interpreting, and not necessarily meaning that it's that somebody takes a longer time is not as good, because certain languages, for example, language pair requires more time, like in German or Japanese, where the verb is at the end, and it's also, you know, how you want to. Everything is speed orientated, but I think it's important to think about how to take it slowly or how to take it prudently, because particularly in translation, now that a lot of that is digital, mistakes are being kept, and also the fact that iterations or draft versions are being kept. So, bearing in mind that as soon as it goes into a database, that would be used by someone else that you may not know about. So, I think it's particularly important to think about your output, because everything is now being recycled, however way it's actually being portrayed.
Henry, what happens if you are in a meeting between two high-level politicians and then they hold a press conference and one of them says, well, here's what we discussed and here's what we agreed, and you're like, hang on, I was in this meeting. That's not what you agreed. That's not what was discussed.
I have never encountered that. But, but then it's their meeting. It's not my meeting. And so it is up to the people who are actually are in the press conference to handle that, and how what they want to tell the world and how they want to tell the journalists.
Could you be subpoenaed afterwards and they say, hey Henry, look, the Prime Minister says this happened, but you were there. Can you help us prove that the Prime Minister's lying?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, there's different jurisdictions will have different rules on that. And certainly we've seen that in the States, that's not possible. What the New Zealand law would say, you'll probably have to ask another expert, ask the legal expert on that question. But certainly that's rather uncommon. I mean, it sounds sensationalised, but it's rather uncommon.
Okay. Ethically, though, you would probably be inclined not to break the confidence,
absolutely,
right? Unless you were forced to.
Absolutely. And you know, in those situations, in the unlikely situation like that, then the interpreter would be his or her own legal representation on that regard.
Is it draining?
Yes. But it's all mental processes. It's important to get it right, because what we say or what we write is important. Whether it is like a guest that you've had a few weeks ago on Harry Potter, how his translation would be part of Reo words and Reo vocabulary. Mm-hmm. That's a huge responsibility, as well as the fact that, you know, or you're interpreting for refugee applications or technology transfer in a conference on some major technology. All of that has historical and future implications.
Henry, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Jesse.
I don't have your official job description title here in front of me. Can you tell people what your qualification is?
Well, I think the ideal qualification is the fact that one needs to have certainly language proficiency and then professional training in translation and interpreting, and thereafter it's life.
But you are also a representative on an international body, I believe.
Yes. I was the first Kiwi to be on a UNESCO body, International Federation of Translators, in a
very
French
good
thing.
Thanks, Henry. Lovely to meet you.